Blog Talk Radio.
Hello?
Hello.
I'd like to welcome Congressman Grijalva. Thank you for coming, sir.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
Sir, it is such an honor to speak to you. You have worked so hard on so many very important issues. I almost have to apologize for taking a moment of your time.
Oh, first, it's a job I wanted, and I serve a purpose along with some very good, able, smart colleagues in the Progressive Caucus who do the same thing I do, and that's what's making us more and more effective is more and more like-minded people begin to arrive at Congress and start to change the culture a bit here.
That's great. I normally ask my guests, sir, to talk a little bit about themselves, what made them move from being just another citizen, another consumer, another worker with a family, to a person that has to contribute. What was it in your early life, sir?
I think a lot of it had to do with growing up. You know, the influence on my life were some very important teachers that I had in elementary and junior high and middle school and high school that had an effect, and as well as university. So that whole education part was important. But, you know, my dad probably never got past the sixth grade. My mom, maybe sixth, seventh grade. My dad immigrated from Mexico. I'm a first-generation American. And came to respect him, but also respect the affection and loyalty that he had to this country that had given his kids, me and my sisters, an opportunity that he would have never had elsewhere. And I felt, you know, there's got to be a payback at some point for this good fortune that I've had. And so I got involved in a lot of activist things around you know, war and peace issues, issues dealing with empowerment for Latinos and our civil rights struggle, and the civil rights struggle in general, moving on to more specific things around issues of education, welfare rights, and mostly working in community and on organizing projects and community development projects. And one thing led to another, and then I, in a very kind of strange moment, I got elected to public office. There had never been a Latino elected to the school board in Tucson, Arizona, where I'm from and where I was
born. I saw that. That's amazing, sir.
So we ran with the intention, okay, of running a perfect race so that we could then litigate and ask for separate districts because we were never going to gain representation citywide. Well, I won by 200 votes, and then the die was kind of cast in the public policy arena. But I hope I brought with me some of the advocacy and activist and community organizing instincts that I learned in my younger life. And that's how I got started.
I see from your bio that you worked in community health. You worked at the school board. You worked on environmental issues. You worked on access issues. You worked on transparent government issues. Sir, you're a hero to many, many people. And I think the only reason there's not 100 bridges named after you is just people don't know you're too modest a man.
No, it was that we're all important. As I tell young people that I work with, they're little brick builders. You know, you have to do, before you get into this kind of life that I have now, which is elective office and very public, you have to have a life. You shouldn't just sprout up. You know, there's a lot of careerist politicians that start out, oh, I'm going to be a congressman. That's their goal in life. And I think your goal in life should be, I'm going to live a life. And from those life experiences, then turn to public service and do it right.
You know, I'm so impressed, sir, that you worked for the environmental issues, you worked for human rights issues, you worked for education issues. You really had built a career of public service way before you entered Congress. And I'm sure that work that you did on the community level weighs on you every day with what you're seeing in Congress.
Yeah, I think that's part of the frustration because the community work, there's an immediacy to it, an urgency to it. People don't have a home, people that can't get health care, that's immediate and urgent. And here, sometimes those very real situations, and it's not just one or two people, it's millions and millions of Americans across this nation, are seen as, especially by the more extremist branch of the Republican Party, the Tea Party, as seen as, unintended consequences, collateral damage, and I've never been able to see it that way. There's an urgency. So the frustration is not to deal with those things in an urgent way because that's the way realistically it's going on out there, you know.
I see that you've done work to protect the Grand Canyon from some of the mining interests. You worked on landscape conservation issues with the Department of the Interior. It must be very frustrating to see these areas that you know are so important be underfunded, to be neglected.
You're killing something with, you know, a dull stick, slowly pounding at it. And, you know, the resources that we deny our special places and our public lands are resources that we're denying the American people. And as the legacy degrades, then here comes others that want to exploit the resource for whatever they can extract from it or whatever they can build on it that shouldn't be there. Then they come at a convenient time when the landscape starts to degrade because of lack of upkeep, lack of visitors because we have no guides and nobody to provide the instruction, and lack of attention to these special places. One of the things that I am proud of is that I think it's very important that there was a distinction made between these are environmental issues and these are civil rights issues, and the two should not meet. And I have always felt that there was an interconnection to all of those things, and besides being an interconnection, there was a mutual alliance that could, should, and would be developed in the future. And you see more and more of that, where there's no... Those kinds of issues shouldn't have exclusivity. They shouldn't be mutually exclusive. And I'm happy and I'm proud of the work to try to forge some alliances with urban America and the conservation community and the preservation community. And in doing so, I think we strengthen the future of these great places like the Grand Canyon, like Petrified Forest in Arizona, like wilderness areas, redwoods. You help their long-term survival because you've expanded the constituency that supports those places.
I couldn't agree with you more. The building of coalitions is what's going to protect us from these rapacious abusers of the environment and of human rights. You're absolutely right. There is no separation there. That leads me to one of the initiatives I know that you're supporting, something called the Green Scissors Plan. I know it troubles me whenever I hear people talk about entitlements. They only talk about cutting social services. They never talk about the abusive subsidies to industries like coal and oil and gas and timber and nuclear. Can I trouble you to talk for a moment about the Green Scissors
Plan? Oh, absolutely. We went through this other bittersweet process on New Year's Eve and to reach some accommodation so we could move forward on other issues. But the fact remains that, you know, everybody said, well, all the tax rate issues settled, Now let's move on just to spending, ignoring the fact that in that very bad budget deal that the president made 2 years ago, in which $1.5 trillion has already been cut from the programs that you spoke to, that you spoke about just now, and now we're going to compound that by additional issues, by threatening Social Security, by threatening Medicaid and Medicare, and saying that symbolically this has to be the head on the stick for the right wing. We must have cuts in benefits and cuts in these programs when that is not the driver of the deficit. Having said that, I think there is so much revenue that is not on the table. Transaction fee in Wall Street would create billions and billions of dollars in revenue that you could then use to sustain programs, investment programs, jobs, education, etc., and begin to deal with the deficit reduction. There is the subsidies to go to gas, oil, coal. There are the and not only the subsidies, the R&D that the government paid for that developed these industries. You can't even account for that. And now, why do we continue to subsidize the most profitable energy sectors in the world with American taxpayers' money? Mineral extracted from public land, be that gold, uranium, whatever, copper, not one penny in royalties is paid for that extraction. And the list goes on. The itemized tax deductions, the ability to shelter offshore money for corporations, the ability for huge corporations like GM getting away with paying no taxes at all. That revenue needs to be on the table, because to take it out of the back of working America, older America, and emerging America is patently unfair. Those that have profited and created the fiscal mess that we're in should have a level of responsibility to contribute to fixing that mess, and so far they haven't.
You're absolutely right, sir, and I couldn't agree more. The idea of just making sure these people who are clearly benefiting from the American infrastructure pay their fair share. We have an energy company here in Florida called Florida Power and Light. They made $14 billion in profits, and not only did they not pay tax, they got rebates.
Exactly. That's my, yeah.
When you look, you know, these people talk about small businesses. Well, there's a small business that walked away not just with $14 billion, but with tax benefits too. And you know, you're going to turn to some citizen and say, you need to pony up your Medicaid benefits. It just doesn't make any sense.
So, no, and I think the American people, because political differences aside, I'm also like a completely believe in the deep decency and sense of fairness of the American people, and I think they're catching up with what we're just talking about. They're beginning to see that this system is skewed against them. That what they came to believe about the American dream, fairness, work hard, pay by the rules, your chance will come. They see those doors closing to them, and they see the gain somewhere else. And it's not with families that they know, and it's not with communities they know. I think that realization is coming to pass, you know, and I'm very optimistic that that's going to help drive the political change that's going to affect this culture here in D.C. And I hope President Obama, with a renewed sense of confidence, with some strength, does provide that third very important center of power in the administration to resist deals that are going to aggravate the bad deals that we've already made in the last 3 or 4 years.
Right. Sir, let me ask you a couple tactical questions.
Sure.
You, like I said, you to me, sir, are an absolute hero. But I also want to talk to you because you're in the cut and thrust of it. You're there in Congress with this wonderful background, this wonderful history of fighting the tough battles against I won't say overwhelming odds, because there are times when the working people of this country have won. But let me ask you some tactical questions, sir. The Tea Party, which seems to have captured the imagination of the Republicans, they take stands and essentially drag the Republican Party along with them. The few semi-moderates that are left, they stand and take various tough stands and ignore the leadership and bring their party's leadership along with them. I'm wondering, sir, at what point does the Congressional Progressive Caucus need to say to those fellow travelers in the Democratic Party that there are places we will not go, there are cuts we will not make?
I think that crucible period is upon us. We will claim partial victory for dealing directly with our leadership in the House, dealing with the leadership in the Senate and Democratic Party, and dealing with the administration, where 120 of us signed a letter. If you, in these discussions, if you put Social Security, CPI, raising the age, we're not voting for it. And you know, these kind of deals are the ones that lead progressives and Democrats over the cliff, because in order to pass these deals, you have to have a vast majority of the Democrats vote for it, and then 60 or 70 Republicans, and it passes the House. And I think we've reached a crucible point, because here we go again. We have the debt ceiling, which the president said, I'm not going to negotiate, and I'm going to take him at his word, because we shouldn't. Then we have the whole automatic tax cuts and the budget for next year, where the chant in the House of Representatives, where the Republicans still hold power, is spending cuts, entitlements, got to cut them. And I think that line is coming up, and it is upon us, and you're absolutely correct. We have to do it again. We fought hard for the public option and lost because it was for the greater good of getting health reform passed. We can debate whether that was the greater good or not, and we should have hung in there for the public option, but we didn't. But now we come to a point that this is a fundamental value of the Democratic Party: Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, greater good for the greater number of people value. And now, to be asked by whoever, leadership or administration, to go back on this value, jump over the cliff, and effectively assure defeat for our party in the next coming election, I think is going to be the crucible point. Many of us have made the commitment that if those things are on the table, we're not going there, and we'll be about the business of growing that momentum and growing the number of people that would be willing to buck the administration and their president and buck our leadership.
Just to share something with you, I have seen in this state, I've been an activist here for about 30 years, I saw in the last couple of years for the first time environmental activists, human rights activists, labor activists, all seeing that commonality of interest. And it's been really a wonderful thing to see, because when these forces come together, that's a very important coalition.
No, it's very powerful.
People too.
You know, I'm a product of that coalition. They elected me and they've kept me in office. And so, and that base is essential. That base and the emerging America, the emerging forces in this, that coalition, the emerging forces, communities of color, young people, women, progressives, environmentalists, also put the president back in office. And that's something to be proud of, but I also think that we owe that coalition, who sometimes has turned the other cheek many times when we've made political decisions are made that do not go toward the greater good for the greater people, that this is a time where there is a debt owed. And I think making sure that we are solid with the commitments that we made while we're running for office and holding us to it, I think that's what that coalition of people can do to make sure that their interests continue to be number one. We're not going to win all our fights, but, you know, you don't know if you're going to win or not if you don't try.
That's for sure.
You got to get in a fight first. And I think this crucible time on these programs and the devastation that could happen to education and job creation and investment in this country, where we're reconciling a generation of people to be second-class Americans, and that's not our value. I think that's the crucible point, and I agree with you. I think we're going to be called upon to either step up, or if we fold, know that we've done that and effectively hurt progressive politics and Democrats for a long, long time.
Sir, let me ask you another, a tactical question. And I realize there are no easy answers, but I just want your take because I do believe that your heart is absolutely in the right place. Let me ask you this. When the civic discussion is wrapped all around cuts and deficits, doesn't that crowd out a discussion that might be about protecting and enhancing Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security?
Absolutely. No question about it. You know, part of the discussion that we have in the Progressive Caucus here is that we're, you know, that the tail's always wagging the dog with regard to what's important to the American people. And so the messaging starts about deficit, the debt ceiling, which is really a non-debatable point and shouldn't be. You authorize expenditures, you got to pay the bills, period. And so what's happened is that cuts, deficit, the economic well-being of the stateship, the country, is at risk. Those dominate the discussion, and unfortunately have put progressives and the Democratic leadership in Congress on the defensive. Our whole discussion has been lately about all revenue on the table. You're not being honest. We have to talk about everything, and defense is not sacrosanct. I think the opportunity to try to change the conversation is there, but it's a little bit uphill, my friend.
Oh, I'm sure.
It's been allowed to fester to the point where the only alternatives are cut or how deep. And we're trying to... Our fight is going to be to shift it, and maybe one way to shift it is not to go along with them. And I agree with you, and that's part of the momentum that needs to be built across the country in order to get enough members to say no, that there's a whole different way to look at this thing.
I want to compliment the Progressive Caucus. There was a wonderful jobs tour that was undertaken to talk to Americans across the country about their situations regarding jobs. And I know myself and many others hope to see more working people or formerly working people testifying. Those voices, the voices of people whose homes were taken in this incredible foreclosure debacle. You have a wonderful resource with those tapes. I hope to see those somehow part of the public record.
And part of what we're going to be planning at our retreat is a 10-city tour talking about investment and job creation, and the words that you use, strengthening, protecting, and enhancing those vital programs of the American people, kind of take it in that direction. Our response to these cuts that's being discussed is soon you will be seeing a list of where revenue exists protected either by tax code, subsidy, rebate, or practice, or lack of oversight, and where we think we could deal with this deficit reduction, strengthen the programs, invest in some things, and not cut or affect people. You know, that's not a pipe dream. That's putting what should be on the table on the table. If we can, that's what we're going to try to do, and once again, begin to rally the American people around an agenda that creates security in employment and invest in their community and in the babies that are coming up that also require a future.
Sir, if I can ask you another economic question. You know, we're seeing these corporations going bankrupt and dumping their pension responsibilities on the taxpayers. I wonder at what point do we have to hold these people responsible for what
they're doing. I use that unfortunate practice, and I think it's more of a business practice than an economic practice than a real fiscal problem of negating even union contract pension agreement.
Right.
And so what happens? What happens is now you talk about Social Security, which now is becoming more and more for retired Americans their only income because of what's going on with pension. Pension reform is not just about adjustments, and I think that is underlining practice that I'm glad you brought it up, that not enough attention is brought to. I worked with steel workers back home. Company went bankrupt, took its assets overseas. These are men and some women that have been working in the mines 20, 25 years. Zero. Not even 10 cents on the dollar. They lost it all. What it does to a person in the twilight of their life is devastating. And that's being repeated all over America. And I think it's a business practice and a strategy more than it is a real economic and fiscal crisis that the company has.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you another tough question. And I ask this, sir, because you're a man with, I know, a deep-centered sense of justice. And we see whistleblowers brought into court time and time again for giving information out. And yet we see Wall Street speculators walking scot-free. This is really irritating and
yeah, I know. Yeah.
And so many
and
people.
You see it, and it's a double standard. Hopefully, not an accepted double standard, but nevertheless, and you know, to acquiesce to that on the part of government, and not strengthen those protections, and not put some walls of separation between enforcement activities and what the whistleblower is bringing to the table in terms of companies or agencies or government practices. I think is a double standard that shouldn't be tolerated. I have two articles up in my office back home in Tucson, and on the same day, this homeless person was arrested for stealing bread, milk, and other food items from a convenience store and got 3 years. Next to him is a businessman that swindled investors out of $3 billion and got 3 years. The point being that one was a necessity issue, the other one was a practice. And
sure.
I keep those two up there just because it's kind of the contrast is kind of interesting, you know.
Sir, this is a terrible tragedy for our great country and for a country that's been known for centuries as a home of justice. We see it leaking away. One other question I want to ask you, sir, and I know it's not an easy one. We see organizations like ALEC and Crossroads essentially tampering with the integrity of the American electoral system. Is there nothing that can be done? I know Citizens United, which is such a poorly named problem, doesn't really strike to it. These people are tampering with the electors.
Yeah, I think the harbinger of much of this, Citizens United, okay, but also ALEC in the fact that it has manipulated, written, and created legislation. In my home state, they wrote 1070, and they wrote it for the private prison industry, so they could fill those prisons with undocumented that were then summarily arrested as a consequence of that law, and then the federal government, Homeland Security, added to that by almost 10 times its effort at putting people in detentions that had never been done historically. And the point being that there was a profit to be made. ALEC represents industry. Some of the groups have gotten off because of some of the practices that they have. But it has been an industry, conservative, right-wing organization that has created both seated it with a lot of state legislatures, that members of the legislature that think like them and follow their lead. And Citizens United, at this point, I hate to admit it, even the whole issue of just disclosing who you are, who are paying for these ads, who is funding these attacks, has been impossible to get out of the House of Representatives. I would suggest that I think the route to continue to put attention on the corrupting influence of dark money in our political process, how it's robbing our democracy, is the amendment process to effectively bring in public financing or bring in a disclosure and legal standards on contributions that are rigid, strong, and enforceable.
Well, sir, thank you very, very much. Is there any final words you'd like to offer?
Yeah, you know, we had a nice sobering discussion, but I'm a great believer in the resilience of the American people. I'm a great believer in the fact that history is always on our side. And I think that's my approach, and I really think that should be the approach, that sometimes some of my most earnest and committed good people, activists out there, get so despondent and frustrated by what they see and what they can't change, and that considering giving up, it would be the worst mistake, because inevitably history will turn. And we'll be in good shape, because I really believe the American people are beginning to catch hold of the fact that this country of theirs is not as much theirs as it used to be, and I think they'll change it.
Well, thank you, sir, for all the work that you've done. And you can call upon the progressive community anytime for anything, sir. You are a hero. Thank you.
You take care. Have a good one.
Take care, sir. Bye-bye. Ladies and gentlemen, that was the unconquerable co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, Congressman Raul Grijalva, 3rd District of Arizona. Thank you, sir. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Glad you could join us. And this is Richard Spisak, news director, saying there's a better world coming.
There was earth to plow, or guns to bear, I was always there, right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream, with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, have you spare a dime? Once I built a tower, up to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once dressed in khaki suits. Gee, we look swell. Full of that Yankee doodly down. Half a million boots went slogging through hell. And I was the kid with the drum. Say, don't you remember? They called me Al. It was Al all the time. Why don't you remember? I'm your pal. Say, buddy, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suit, ah, gee, we looked swell. Full of that Yankee doodle-dum. Half a million boots went slogging through hell. And I was the kid with a drum. Oh, say, don't you remember? They called me Al. It was Al all the time. Say, don't you remember? I'm your pal. Buddy, can you spare?
Ladies and gentlemen, that was Bing Crosby singing that wonderful old tune, Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? And in just a moment, we're going to have Susan Smith on, president of the Democratic Progressive Caucus of Florida. And she'll be telling us about some upcoming events. So stick around.
Fly specks. I've been spending my life among fly specks while miracles have been leaning on lampposts at 18th and Fairfax.
A few words of wisdom from our friends in the film Harvey. And now, ladies and gentlemen, Susan Smith, president of the Democratic Progressive Caucus of Florida. Susan, welcome.
Thank you, Rick. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you back on the show. You've done such a wonderful job bringing us those candidates for the Florida Democratic Party chair. How's that all going?
Oh, it's more exciting every day. I want to thank you again for giving everybody the opportunity to hear the candidates. I think that was a great service that you performed for the Democratic Party grassroots to let us be able to hear the candidates and have our questions answered. So, you know, the election's coming up in Orlando, actually Lake Mary, on January 26th. So we're getting close.
And Susan, for progressives who are not that close to the party processes, could you explain who actually will be voting for that chair of the Democratic Party?
Yes, the state committee men and women will be voting. The elected officials will be voting, the elected Democrats, and the club and caucus presidents have a vote, just a single vote. The votes are weighted depending on the office somebody holds or depending upon the Democratic performance in your county. For example, I think Hillsborough County has 66 weighted votes, so each the state committee man will have 33 and the state committee woman will have 33. At least I think that's what the numbers are. I'm not sure where you can find that information, but it will be available that day. But it is a weighted vote, which gives priority to the counties who had a higher Democratic performance in the last election.
Oh, it's
very
such
complicated.
Such an interesting process.
Yes, and we would like to see the process changed in some way. I'm not sure how, but we don't like the process the way it is now. We think it, I think it's too open to kind of extortion. You know, people ask for things in order. People are trading votes, and I'm not sure we like that as Democrats. But that's the way it is done now.
Well, I think just the fact that these people came and spoke to the community at large, I think that's a step in the right direction. And again, I You deserve no small thanks for that, my dear, and I salute you for that effort. And also the two fine ladies who accompanied you, they asked excellent questions. And I think, by and large, we got pretty good answers. I think there seemed to be an agreement from the candidates that they wanted to make this a more transparent, more democratic process. And I think for the Democratic Party, that's a step in the right direction.
I think you're right. And I can't really take any credit for this, because the credit goes to you and Mickey, and somebody on our board is the person that suggested it. I don't think it was even I know it wasn't my idea. I forget who it was on our board, the Progressive Caucus board, that suggested we ask you to host the candidates. And then, of course, thank you to the candidates for giving up their time to answer our questions.
Well, Susan, besides being president of the Democratic Progressive Caucus of Florida, you're involved in so many arenas. What have you been working on lately?
Well, tomorrow night in Tampa, we have a DFA Action Summit. We're going to be talking about lobbying our legislators and how we go about it and how we speak to the legislature. If we want to speak before a hearing or a meeting, if we want to have a face-to-face meeting with our legislator, how we do it. So it's kind of a pre-LegiCamp training that we're doing here in Hillsborough County. Franco Caliz, the Southern Organizer for Democracy for America, is going to be giving the training for us. We have about 25 people, I think, signed up at the moment. We can take more. So if anybody's interested, you can contact me, stsmith222@aol.com, for information, or go to the Democracy for America website. It's listed there now as an event under training. I went to a direct link, so I'm not sure how to find it on the website, but it is on the website. You can RSVP there. We have a Facebook event set up also. But we are looking forward to that tomorrow night. And then we have LegiCamp on the 9th of February in Orlando at City Hall. If you go to LegiCamp.com, LegiCamp.com, that will take you directly to the Eventbrite invitation. And you can RSVP. It's a $20 cost to attend LegiCamp, and that includes lunch. So we don't think it's a bad deal. It will be at City Hall. There are parking garages around in Orlando where you can park, and then we'll probably do some kind of social event afterwards. LegiCamp is a unique experience. This will be the third one the Florida Progressives have put on. This is not a caucus activity. This actually predates the Progressive Caucus, when a group of us got together. You were there in Orlando January. Yes, January of 2011, we decided to try to get better organized in the state, and Edwin and CISO presented the idea of doing LegiCamp based on the Roots Camp model. So we came together a few weeks later in Orlando prior to the legislative session and organized ourselves for actions during the session, and that's where Awake the State was born. So these things do kind of generate new things and more progressive types of activity. So we're hoping to have at least 125 people for LegiCamp. I encourage people to register right away, because space is limited for that. And then, of course, we have our caucus meeting. That's something else I can talk about.
You know, those the LegiCamp idea of bringing people together, helping them understand how the legislative process works. We had attendance from several officials. We had good Democrats who work for us in Tallahassee show up, and it was a really wonderful chance for people to get together, and a great way to meet progressives from across the state and find common ground and common resources. And that's right. There's a Progressive Caucus event on the 27th. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yes, it will be held in the same location as the Florida Democratic Party event on the 26th. We're just going to be having our meeting the next day. It will be from 9 to 1 at the Lake Mary Marriott, and I forget the name of the room they've put us in, but we saw it yesterday. I went over for a little site inspection and saw the room, and So we're gearing up for that. It will be a business meeting and our election for new officers and board. And it's so only members can vote on the business, only people who were members at the 1st of December. I know somebody wrote a critical comment about that on our Facebook page, but those are bylaws driven, those decisions. You have to be a caucus member for 45 days prior to the election in order to get to vote in the election. You can vote on regular business if you join that day. So we'd love to have everybody join the caucus. You can join by going to our website, progressivedemcaucusfl.org, and up to the, I think it's where you contact us, you can find the link to the page to join the caucus. And it's only $25 for a year. We still think, I think we're the best bargain out there as far as caucuses go. We probably will at some point raise our dues a little, but for now it's $25 a year to join. So we'd love to have more people join our group, and we are looking to start local caucuses in the coming year or two. So I hope we can drum up more interest that way. So please join us January 27th.
Mm-hmm. Excellent, excellent. It's something that you definitely should attend. You know, so many progressives feel that the old standard business as usual parties don't seem to represent their interests. The Progressive Caucus is a great way to bring that progressive energy of yours to bear. It is a wonderful organization, and clearly there's a wonderful group of people involved, very bright, very progressive people, and people who are determined to make a difference. And that's something that we all want to see in this often far too calculated, jaded, and manipulated world. You know, Susan, I was going to ask, a lot of people, who anybody who's paid attention has heard that this caucus and that caucus haven't endorsed this chair and that chair. Has the Progressive Caucus endorsed one of the chair candidates?
No, we haven't endorsed, and we don't plan to. We said that from very early on, that we would not take a position in the race. We felt like our mission was to present a platform for people to learn more about the candidates. We have one vote in this, but we want people to make their opinions known to their own state committee men and women within the party. You know, do your homework. That's what we've encouraged people to do. And then, you know, go ahead and speak to the people who cast a vote. But we didn't want to feel like we were influencing that in any way. We just felt it was our duty to give people a voice in the process, which we did. We also just, you know, this is, it's gotten pretty ugly in a lot of ways, this race has. Some of the surrogates have gotten pretty nasty and gone after our progressive infrastructure in the state, and I have not been happy about that. I don't think it's necessary to tear down people who aren't really even running for office. You know, you don't have to tear down those people in the process of running this election. Again, I think it's because it's a process that's not fair. And if we had a more open process where grassroots people got to vote, you know, I don't know that it's possible to do one vote per precinct person, you know, where everybody who runs and represents their own precinct has an equal vote. I don't know if that's a possibility, but, you know, that's one option for the future that I would like to see changed. But no, we will not be endorsing.
Well, I think in a way it's a very, very laudable approach, because once again, it to me shows the Democratic penchant, the progressive penchant for facts and information and teaching rather than imposing a decision. So I want to salute you for that. I'm sure you're instrumental in that kind of thinking. And as I say, the good progressive coalition for bringing together those candidates. You know, and I know that any other group could have done it before. This is not a new idea in the world, but it was a good idea. And I think I was very happy to help. So that being said,
we've got this. For what you've done.
We've got this great thing coming up on the 27th, the Progressive Caucus, and then the Ledger Camp coming up. Are there any rumblings about another Awake the State adventure coming up?
You know, we haven't talked about that. I'm sure somebody will propose it at probably at Ledger Camp. We'll learn more about it. I don't know. I haven't seen anything on the Awake the State. We do have some Awake the State groups who are constantly doing actions. The group in St. Pete is very active, the Pinellas Awake group, and I think they've got an action tonight, maybe a healthcare, some type of healthcare action. There's something on transportation next week. So we've taken our activism to different levels, you know, locally. So I'm not sure if anybody's going to propose that we do something statewide on the first day of session. It doesn't come until March, so we're still quite a ways out from that. But if you want to know, you can come to Ledger Camp on February 9th and find out what's going on. But we're excited just to be able to meet with everybody. Again, as you said earlier, this is such an opportunity to work across silos. You know, one of the purposes of doing it was to help people break out of their silo where they're so focused on only one issue. They don't know what anybody else is doing. And it's so good for us to come together and understand what the, you know, the women's groups are doing or what the education groups are doing. So when we come under attack or we have something positive we want to push through, we've got allies in our fight. And that's what Ledger Camp is all about, building allies in this legislative session that's coming up.
Are there any guest speakers at our event on the 27th or the February Ledger
Camp? Yes, I'm glad you asked. We don't have anybody, I don't think, lined up yet for Ledger Camp. Senator Nan Rich, who's a candidate for governor, is going to be speaking at the meeting on the 27th in Lake Mary. We're trying to get Representative or Congressman Alan Grayson to come again because he's a great friend of the caucus and he wants to come. We're just not quite sure what his schedule is yet because if he's in town, he's going to come. We just won't know for sure until the event, but we know that will draw a lot of people in because progressives sure love Congressman Grayson.
You know, Susan, one of the other things I think these progressive caucus events have done, whether you're talking about Awake the State or Ledger Camp, from talking to progressive activists across the state as well as legislators, this is beginning to make an impact. This is a group that's beginning to catch some political air and political heat simultaneously. Is that what you're hearing from people involved in Tallahassee?
You know, I hope so. I don't know about Tallahassee. I think we're having an impact in the Democratic Party. I think Senator Rich gave us credit for fighting along with everybody else, but she gave us credit for this parent trigger campaign that we have to fight the parent trigger bill. We fought it off last session, and we're going to be fighting it this session, and we started our fight back in the summer, as you recall, mm-hmm. at the Jefferson Jackson dinner down in South Florida. That's when we launched our campaign, and I think that was a huge effort because what it showed all the Democrats who were running for office who had not yet been elected and the ones who were in office, we got our opinion out there, you know, kind of on the ground floor so that people know if this comes into the legislature, if it's introduced in a committee during this next, well, this week, I think they're in Tallahassee meeting in committee, people are going to know, and they're going to be aware of what parent trigger is, and I think we've had a big impact on that. I think we had an impact, and I'll be talking about some of this on the 27th. I think the fact that we took early positions on the amendments, although everybody didn't agree with the positions we took, the fact that we took them, we were able to get our voice heard through media. We were asked to write opinion pieces for Florida Voices and for Sunshine State News and some other outlets, you know, on the amendments. And I think we helped educate a lot of people on the amendments this last cycle. And we, I, maybe inspired other groups to take to do their homework and take positions also. So I think there are ways to have impact. In the beginning, it's been hard for us to have an electoral impact, but I think we've had an impact in other ways, you know, as a new caucus that I'm really proud of.
Well, thank you again for your time, and I hope all you progressives listening out there are going to join us on the 27th after you join up. And we'll
yes, we want you to be a member.
Thanks so much, Susan.
Thank you, Rick. Thanks for everything.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Good work. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Okay, friends, that was Susan Smith, president of the Democratic Progressive Caucus. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
They said the students scared the guards, though the troops were battle-dressed. For mothers and their new degrees, the fashionable. I know we're all fed up with useless wars and racial strife. The next time they will ride, well, you best stay out of sight. When there's a ride going on. When there's a ride going on.
That's it for today. Solidarity and peace.